Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Soupcast, coming to you from ArchaeoSoup Towers. By popular demand, we're taking selected videos from the ArchaeoSoup back catalogue and bringing them to you as convenient podcasts. As the name implies, with ArchaeoSoup, you get a bit of everything thrown into the pot. Archaeology, discussion, humour and debate. You can find out more at archaeosoup.com. So sit back, relax, and enjoy a hearty helping of Archaeo Soup.
Hello, and welcome back to Watching Brief for the week of the 20th of December, 2021. I am joined, as ever, by my amazing co-host, Mr. Andy Brockman. Good afternoon, Andy.
Good afternoon from Plague City.
Plague City, indeed, yes. For our viewer at home, London is a hotspot, a global hotspot, in fact, world-beating, one might say, at the moment, when it comes to the Omicron variant. But here, at least at ArchaeoSoup Towers, we're getting in the festive mood. We're slightly more decorated than Mr. Brockman appears to be, and also, the in-laws are on their way.
Oh, well, I'm, as you might guess from the bottle of whiskey on the shelf behind me, I'm going to be absolutely lit up later Christmas night.
Andy, the red-nosed archaeologist, had a very show. Yes, in our case, yes, they've just boarded the ferry about half an hour ago from Northern Ireland. So it's going to be great to see them. Yeah, I guess we'll see what happens in terms of Christmas lockdowns, though. I mean, that might be on the cards. They may be with us into January. Who knows?
Well, I mean, I'm surprised to hear actually you're not flying the in-laws in by reindeer slayer, given your headwear and everything.
Well, I know this hat does give me a certain amount of power, but at the moment I'm trying to just maintain a stable internet connection for our Zoom calls. So no, they're getting the ferry and they'll be here.
Like Father Christmas, I'll believe that when I see it.
As will I. This week we have...
Anyway.
Yeah, regardless of whether we're in a plague city or wearing magical hats, we have our ongoing Watching Brief. And we have a couple of stories that may well bring a smile to your face. Or indeed as...
Or a tear to your eye.
Or a tear to your eye. Potentially, yes. Yeah. So, it's, you know, it depends on how you view it. A bit like an onion in that sense. You know, nicely cooked onion in butter, very sweet, delicious. But a raw onion can be a bit acerbic and make you cry, perhaps. Before we dive into those two segments, the second of which, incidentally, has a special guest this week as well, who may also be joining us for the recording of the Muppet of the Month segment. I'd just like to highlight the link of the week. This week, it's a bit of fun. As I say, we're in Christmas week, and it is a link highlighting a fairly, relatively old build, actually. So this is a story that they've picked up on this year, this website, but I think this is from a couple of years ago, where an amazing Lego model was built that encompasses the entire sequence of events in the opening temple escape in the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark. So It's a bit of fun, a bit of Lego.
You mean the sequence when Indy's stealing indigenous culture?
Yeah. Well, actually, interestingly, you can get plaques on Etsy for your replicas of Indiana Jones' treasures, and people on those plaques, I think they label them as having been reclaimed by Indiana Jones. So reclaimed from, I don't know, uncivilized people, who knows? So it's don't think about it. It's Indiana Jones, it's Christmas, it's Lego. Shush. 1 million records of archaeological finds made by public now recorded. It doesn't necessarily make sense objectively, that sentence, I think, maybe out of context. But that is to say 7 days ago at the British Museum, Arts Minister Lord Parkinson of Whitley Bay, as in Whitley Bay a few miles from me. Crikey, Lord Parkinson. Is that a real person?
It's called levelling up. You two can become a member of the House of Lords if you cite somewhere in the northeast.
Wow. Okay. Crikey.
Oh yeah.
Lord Parkinson, anyway, of Whitley Bay, launched the Treasure Annual Report for 2019 and the Portable Antiquities PAS Annual Report for 2020. These showed that 49,045 archaeological finds were made and recorded throughout the first year of the pandemic. This number is a little lower than the previous years, as opportunities for metal detectorists to record their finds were limited due to lockdown measures and the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. However, in amongst all of the documentation was the headline that the 1 millionth record logged on the PAS database was a copper alloy medieval harness pendant, not pedant, as I wrote in our agenda.
And not pedant, as you had in the original time. Yes, exactly.
Pendant found in a place called Binbrook. In Lincolnshire. This is accession number NLMB7AFF3, for those of you who are interested at home. Now, interestingly, they go on to say that over 1.5 million finds have been recorded by the PAS, but some database records include more than one item. So this isn't the 1 millionth artifact. This is the 1 millionth record. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas and Merry Christmas to the PAS and all the hardworking fellows and so on. Look, I'm sorry, I mean that, of course. The thing is, this is an exercise that happens every year when the PAS puts out a press release about how many finds have been made and logged in the previous year. Just to explain to our viewer, in case anyone's not familiar, the PAS, or Portable Antiquities Scheme, is a scheme that is administered from the British Museum.
Yes.
And it does two things. It has a network of what are called finds liaison officers, to whom members of the public can voluntarily report archaeological finds that they make out while they're out and about. Mm-hmm. It is not just about metal detecting, although it was set up in the mid-1990s as a response to the rise in metal detecting, in the sense that many, many archaeological finds were going unrecorded and disappearing into private collections without ever being seen or heard of by archaeologists. Mm. It's a voluntary scheme. Finds liaison officers log the artifacts. They go onto an open source database where they're available for anyone to see and to use for research. And in fact, if you want access to the high level data, like precise locations and so on, you can register as a bona fide researcher. Mm. And many, many people do. For example, a good friend of the show, Reb Ellis, is currently completing a PhD on Iron Age metal, animals in Iron Age metal finds, and is drawing heavily on PAS material for that. Mm. So there's a community of researchers who basically rely on the PAS for information. It also offers basic, although you have to be careful how you use it, for example, distribution charts in particular, of particular kinds of find, are heavily reliant on reports to the PAS. Mm. Some archaeologists would argue the downside to it is that, first of all, it gives undue prominence to metal detecting, because other kinds of finds are also reportable. Yeah. There are other kinds of portable antiquity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the main one is that it's a voluntary scheme and still doesn't catch everything.
No.
There are anecdotal reports of people who, for example, refuse to report to the PAS or refuse to report accurately to the PAS because they're afraid of losing permissions, because site It might draw attention to a site which then becomes scheduled, which means that means then they wouldn't be allowed to detect on it, and so on and so on and so on. So again, there's a lobby, I won't say how large it is in archaeology, that suggests that the whole thing is actually far too permissive, and that at the very least fines, because they are of a collective heritage, should be it should be compulsory to report fines if you find something.
Well, and it's interesting. First of all, I should say it looks like the press release misspelled the find location. It wasn't Binbrook, it's Binbrook with an R, Binbrook. Okay. I double checked its location.
Yeah.
So that's Binbrook in Lincolnshire. Secondly, it's interesting how in this press release, they, as you say, because of this prominence and because of the fact that it's voluntary and the fact because the people have to volunteer their discoveries as well and not come to an arrangement, for example, with the landowner, for example, they have to include in the statement things like metal detectorists greatly adding to our understanding of Britain's past. And there was another story recently as well, which was very similar, where I saw people commenting saying, yes, but what, not how much is this find worth, but what is it, where is it from, what does it tell us about, arguably the PAS does skew and in a way is encouraged to skew by the nature of how it works, how people view the artifactual history of this country. Just also as well, a little extra bit of information about the copper alloy pendant. It was medieval, but it specifically dated to the late 14th century, so 1350 to 1400 in terms of date. And Michael Lewis, head of the PAS, said each find was part of the great jigsaw puzzle of our past. Now, again, it's really interesting because, we always come back to this with the PAS, don't we? Is this simply the lesser of two or maybe uncountable evils in that sense? Because having this slightly blingy relationship with artifacts and records of artifacts, not only highlights value and individual, individual named discoverers and discoveries, as opposed to stories that those artifacts are attached to. But also it continues to encourage people like, for example, the head of the PAS, to use language which is actually quite outdated. I mean, back in the 1980s, archaeologists were deconstructing the notion that archaeology is in fact something there to be reconstructed, that there is, for example, one truth to be found, that a jigsaw puzzle, I think Shanks and Tilly, for example, challenged the notion that that archaeologists are akin to Sherlock Holmes, that we can come in and with the right evidence we can distill everything down to a precise notion of what exactly happened with regards to, for example, if you want to use this term, our past, in terms of that's a very broad story, isn't it, our past, but or a murder site, for example, a pile of animal bones from a farm. The real truth is the archaeology is a photo album where most of the pictures are missing, and we're trying to understand what happened in previous generations and so on and so forth. And I just sort of find myself wondering, as good and as necessary as this work is it again this relationship between archaeologists, metal detectorists, and the media that results in something that's at the very least theoretically unsound. And at the very worst, something which makes us all think about, ooh, shiny, as opposed to, ooh, valuable.
That's culture. Really that's a really interesting point. It does go right to the core of this particular argument. I'll make a few points, really. And we're not going to resolve this whole issue just in a 15-minute conversation on what you read. No, we're not. No,
oh, sorry, Mark. Okay. well, that's my Christmas ruined. Okay.
Sorry.
Take it off my wish list.
Yeah, resolve the relationship between archaeologists, metal detectors, the public, and the media.
And well, that's unify quantum and
that's look exactly
quantum theory and. Was it the one, the big and small physics? There you go.
Just take comfort that in some part of the multiverse we've done just that.
Okay.
Right. Look. In this part of the multiverse, the PAS only ever papered over the cracks of a very fractious relationship.
Yeah.
Right. There are archaeologists who will ban metal detecting outright. There are others who see it as a very welcome additional tool to research and at all points in between. Mm-hmm. The PAS, like any entity, puts out positive stories to justify its existence and increase its profile. And this is coming at a time when we've just seen, you know, museums are shutting again through staff shortages. The economics of the cultural sector is fraught, to say the least. Mm. And because of COVID, apart from anything else, and as the press release alluded to, the PAS depends a lot on literally face-to-face recording by finds liaison officers working with the people reporting the finds, primarily metal detectorists. Mm. So the fact they've not been able to do that for much of the last 2 years raises all sorts of questions. For example, while metal detecting was allowed, members of FLOs weren't able to record. So how much has gone unrecorded? Should metal detecting have been banned, as it was at during parts of the lockdown? Mm. Mm. Should it have been banned outright because of the fact that the scheme that was set up to monitor it, if you like, wasn't available to do that monitoring? Except that it's not statutory; it's voluntary.
Yeah.
So therefore, you know, there's no, in a sense, that I've answered my own question. There's no justification for that. They could cancel metal detecting on health grounds, not on heritage grounds. Mm. Mm. It's not easy.
No. Well, and the funny thing is that a friend commented on this when the story first came out last week, and they said, they messaged saying, "Is this a good news story or not?" And that's more or less, I think, where an awful lot of archaeologists are. And this isn't about enmity with metal detecting. It's more about the halfway house that we find ourselves in,
yeah,
in terms of how we deal with all this stuff. And what a note for that particular Christmas announcement for us to end on, I suppose.
Well, all I would say is well, there's a number of things. First of all, we're awaiting the response of the Department for Culture, Media and Sport to a consultation on the future of the Treasure Act. Mm. And that's the other half of the PAS's work. Although it doesn't formally administer the Treasure Act, the British Museum does host the Treasure Advisory Committee, which is a legal entity which handles fines under the Treasure Act. And the fines liaison officers write specialist reports about treasure fines. Mm. So they are involved in that process, although it's not part of the PAS's role, original role. And the consultation was on the basis that the Treasure Act is going to tighten up the definition of treasure so that it's no longer something purely of precious metals, but something of historical value. Mm. The argument is that will catch more finds. It will prevent the sale of nationally important finds like the Crosby Garrett helmet, which was sold privately because it had no precious metal and is now disappeared into a collection and has been seen in public a couple of times, but it's not part of a national collection like the British Museum or the museum in Carlisle, which would be the closest major museum to where it was found. Mm. We're awaiting that. And there's an ongoing debate in archaeology. I mean, my sense, and it's only a sense, is that views in archaeology about metal detecting have hardened a little bit in the last couple of years simply because of the growth of large-scale metal detecting rallies.
Yes.
Which, again, the PAS has a very fraught relationship with. They don't support rallies, which can produce potentially hundreds of fines, which would just overwhelm the ability of a single, you know, local fines liaison officer to log.
Mm-hmm.
They individual metal detectorists at rallies asked to report fines individually. And it goes to the root of how many fines by metal detectorists are actually reported to the PAS.
Mm.
And I would just point people really to two papers, one from December 1916 by Sam Hardy, who's a specialist in conflict antiquities, but also the legal issues behind fines and fines reporting and so on, who wrote a paper analysing the open source data on metal detecting for cultural property, as he puts it in the article, and tries to estimate the scale and intensity of metal detecting and the quantity of metal detected cultural goods. Basically, just trying to get a handle on how much was being found as opposed to how much was being reported.
Yes,
and there was and that was seen broadly as being anti permissive view of metal detecting. A number of researchers who work with PAS material, and including Michael Lewis, the head of the PAS, wrote a response to that paper called The Complexities of Metal Detecting Policy and Practice, a response to Samuel Hardy. That was published in 2017. Those are probably the two clearest academic statements of both sides of the argument. And I'd urge people who are interested in the subject to look behind the press releases and go back and read those papers and maybe others that they might discover consequently and make your own mind up. But, a press release doesn't necessarily equal good thing.
No. And as you say, we're not going to resolve it today, unfortunately.
Absolutely not.
Alas.
Absolutely not.
Alas.
No.
Regardless and again, of the head.
No. And again, I have to add the caveat, as we always do on these things, that in the UK at the moment, metal detecting, it varies a little bit from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. For example, the situation in Scotland is different to the situation in England. And the PAS really covers England. But metal detecting, with the permission of a landowner and observing things like the Ancient Monuments and Archaeological Areas Act and the Treasure Act, is a perfectly legal hobby. There are many metal detectorists who cooperate with archaeologists, work with archaeologists as an important part, effectively, of the geophysics team, including Petuaria, where we were in the summer. There were metal detectorists working as an integral part of the project, and it was very good that they were.
Yes. So we are joined for our second segment of the week by the inimitable, the wonderful, the excellent, the amazing Neil Ackerman. Good afternoon, Neil. How are you doing?
I'm all right. That's probably the best intro I've ever had and will ever have.
Well,
it's Christmas. We're being kind to everybody.
But also, to be fair, you are the only recipient of the Muppet of the Month Award to ever have requested it in order to print it off. I had to design the whole thing for you in order to have it on your office wall. So you are
still on the bookshelf in my office.
Exactly. Yeah, you are well deserving of the introduction. But this week you're going to be helping us discuss someone who was almost a Muppet of the Month, actually. But then we realised that this could actually have some fairly serious and interesting undertones and connotations. And that is the story from the Isle of Skye, where, to quote MSN.com, Scott was, well, a Scott, not Scott. It says here, Scott was fined. A Scott was fined £18,000 for destroying an ancient cairn to help him in his building project. If I switch over to the website Scottish Construction Now, it says, Ian McInnes used the earth from Upper Tot Cairn on the north of Skye to help with a building project elsewhere on his land. The 59-year-old pleaded guilty to damaging the protected monument when he appeared at Portree, I'm guessing, Sheriff Court on the 25th of August on Tuesday, and he was fined a total of £18,000. Mr. McInnes owns the land next to the A855 near Upper Tot on Skye, where the Upper Tot cairn stands. Historic Environment Scotland had written to Mr. McInnes on three separate occasions about the existence of the cairn, with the most recent letter being sent in 2015. The agency also carried out routine site visits every 10 years. But he went on, nonetheless, in 2018 to excavate part of the monument between the 1st and the 12th of December. So it's taken a couple of years, probably because something else happened. I don't know what's happened in the past couple of years, to get around to dealing with this. But Andy Shanks, Procurator Fiscal for Grampian Highlands and Islands, said, "As the owner of the land this ancient monument sits on, it was Duncan McInnes's duty to help protect it. Instead, he showed a complete disregard for its importance when he dug for soil and damaged the Upper Tot cairn."
Can you just explain for my benefit, actually, and perhaps for our viewer too, what kind of historical monument are we actually talking about here? So, date, construction, mm-hmm. use. What are we talking about when we're talking about a Neolithic cairn in a Scottish context?
Funerary monument, so big pile of stones, big large construction that's usually visible from fairly far away, with a chamber of sorts with bodies inside in various stages of decomposition. It's quite common for there to be quite whole skeletons at the back of the tomb. And then kind of disarticulated bones, so they're kind of shifting bodies back as they decompose. It's essentially a massive tomb.
Often, I know in other parts of the UK, you'll find these on ridges in the landscape, so they're visible from, as you say, from fairly far away, possibly linked with community identity and acknowledgement. I don't know if it's the case necessarily on Skye, but certainly in some other Neolithic instances, it's likely that body parts were being moved through the community as well, maybe being passed around ritually and then being returned and swapped out for body parts and bones, particularly in these tombs. How does this read to you? Does this seem like a typical farmer authority interaction?
Well, he's obviously been told several times what it is, and I assume in that was told the consequences of, you know, not adhering to the act that kind of covers scheduled monuments in Scotland. The Historic Environment Scotland do kind of keep a fairly close eye on things. As I said, they kind of site visit every 10 years and they can see what changes there are. Obviously, local authority archaeologists are around kind of closer to it and will probably pick these things up, or often pick these things up sooner. When I was at Aberdeenshire Council, we'd sometimes have members of the public saying, "Oh, there's a stone circle in this farmer's field. They seem to be ploughing close to it," or, you know, they built it in the 90s. But yeah, they're ploughing close to it. just to kind of check that they're within their rights to be doing what they're doing, which almost always they are. You can see the kind of the frustration sometimes if you have a field with a scheduled monument right in the middle of it and you're trying to maximise, you know, the economy of your land, having to go around it all the time with your plough is quite annoying. But I think in general, you know, it's farmers tend to be fairly connected to their land and may have been on it for generations, and I think tend to be more mindful of these things in general and their kind of their obligations to the land in a longer term.
One of the things that caught our eye looking at the story was that in England there have been a couple of similar instances in the last few years that have been prosecuted by Historic England. There was a case of damage to Offa's Dyke on the English-Welsh border recently, and also a Neolithic henge monument that was badly damaged in Somerset by another farmer. Now, again, the motivation in these things is often unclear, and particularly for anybody that wasn't actually in court to listen to the evidence, which is never, you know, fully reported. But in your experience, have you found, or are you aware of any instances where, for example, farmers take the annoyance that you've just described of having to, you know, keep a certain, you know, safe distance from a monument when they're playing, for example, and says, just sort of, you know, F this for a game of soldiers, I'll take the hit, and because my land's more important to me than this abstract monument that isn't any economic benefit to me.
Yeah, and I think there's partly that, and I think there's also partly a bit of kind of kickback, which you can kind of understand, of this is my land and I'm being told what to do with it by people mm-hmm. who don't live here, aren't farmers. You know, I'm being told by a centralized body who are very distant that I can't and can use my land in certain ways. Mm. You know, I kind of have some sympathies with why they might get into that mindset. And I think that's certainly an aspect that the kind of the wider archaeological community needs to be a bit better at kind of doing. And I think in general it's getting better, but there is a very much kind of, we know what's on your land better than you know what's on your land, and we know what you should be doing with that, which often doesn't help.
No, it's interesting because in the case of the and you said the Watts dike, that's a different dike, the Offa's dike damage, I seem to recall the landowner made the case that he wasn't aware that this thing was a monument. And yet, I remember at the time, you and I, Andy, we were sceptical about whether or not it's possible to buy that land and not have some sort of notification come with the legal documentation. You know, it's basically something that goes, you know, this is important. You cannot, you know, for example, bulldoze it, as the guy did.
Well, I mean, apart from anything else, the DEFRA Magic land database includes things like scheduled monuments.
Yeah. Yeah. Well. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So if you do it, it's not just heritage bodies. It's also other yeah. land awareness will bring that to your attention. But nonetheless, that isn't the same sort of communication that I guess an archaeologist might want to bring to the table. Just saying, this is important, don't touch it, is not the same as talking about what it means in the landscape, why it was there, why it might be good to keep it there. Is that sort of maybe something that this is why this didn't become a Muppet of the Month, incidentally, for people at home. It's because actually this feels like this is an element of maybe asking the question, what else could we do in our communication to make sure that people are more inclined to be sympathetic and empathetic, I suppose, actually, to the historic environments around them, and therefore actually to their fellow, you know, their fellow citizens and fellow human beings in that sense. Is it even practical to have like a sit down face to face when someone buys a plot of land like that?
I mean, I think in Scotland there's about 8,000 scheduled monuments.
Yeah.
In total, and I mean some of them are owned by the public, but most of them I think are on privately owned land. I don't know if Historic Environment Scotland do get notified if someone buys the land. I don't know if there would be a legal obligation by the buyer to do that, but there is a legal obligation from the solicitors to notify someone if they're buying land with a scheduled monument on it. I mean, the amount of paperwork you get when you're buying land in that circumstance, it would be easy for that to get lost. And isn't necessarily going to be the forefront of anybody's mind when they're going through that process.
As well, because often you buy land in order to do something with it.
Yeah.
Don't you? You don't buy land to not be able to do something with it, which is, problematic.
Yeah. Again, we're only going by press reports, but it appears that in this case, the landowner appeared to want some, effectively, some hardcore to help build a shed.
Mm.
And it was presumably quicker to go to the local Neolithic cairn than it is to go to the local builder's yard if you're, you know, on the north coast of Skye.
Well, and it was a substantial pile, 9 foot tall off the ground. So it was a big pile of potential hardcore in that sense, just sitting there. Yeah.
I'm interested in what you were saying about the sort of relationship between Historic Scotland and communities and landowners and so on. I'm aware that, you know, again, speaking from south of the border, there's often anyone that's been involved in planning issues, I've been involved in several along the years, is aware that you happily live in exist in an archaeological bubble where everybody cares about heritage and wants to share and wants to make heritage a part of the community. And then you come across an architect or a councillor or a developer who just sees this as sort of, I won't use the word woke now, but as a bunch, as sort of touchy-feely nonsense that's standing in the way of improving the local economy and making lives better for local people. And you have to find a way of negotiating that. And I wonder, is that the kind of thing that maybe, and I'm throwing it out to all three of us, really, you know, is this something archaeologists need to be aware of and maybe learn to deal with in a more effective way?
Right. So from my experience of living in Orkney, where a massive amount of archaeology here, in a place that is pretty much all agricultural land, and there is within the kind of Orkney community tensions sometimes come up between the two, and there is the kind of, again, the idea of a bunch of folk from down south, the central belt of Scotland, which is as down south to Orkney as London is, you know, it's a similar kind of thing where they're standing in the way of Orkney developing and moving on as it wants to by holding it back. So you've kind of got the two extremes right next to one another in Orkney, because if the population is decent for a Scottish island, but we are all kind of mixing together. My first summer when I was doing my undergrad here, I was working in a pub and I was being told by builders about times where they were digging and found some human bones and just kind of shoved them back in again and covered it up because it would stop the job, and they didn't really mind either way. So yeah, I mean, that's there, and it's. I think no one's ever going to all agree on how that should be, and everyone has their views on how land should be used, and that's kind of healthy and fine. I think it's the kind of the looking down your nose at people who are not archaeologists and telling them what their land means, which I don't know if that actually happens consciously from an archaeology point of view, but it's certainly perceived like that. And if that's the perception, then that's kind of on us to change.
It's interesting as well, because, you know, I think we all hear horror stories along those lines, in terms of human remains, in terms of when I was living and working in York, there were stories of you know, because lots of York is anoxic, leather and organic goods were just being tossed into the skip and covered up quickly, you know, because, oh, no, we can't afford to stop for this. And so, I mean, yes, absolutely. One of the, so, you know, when I was talking about this idea of having a face-to-face and talking, trying to describe the meaning of a monument, for example, well, I think what I was imagining would be a conversation, not a prescription. So there's that question of how we actually meet with people and talk to them about what is their land and what is their history and what is their place where they live, or for example, what is their building site, you know, if you're talking to the gaffer or whatever. But then also as well, there's this other thing as well, frankly, it's provision. It's the ability to say, don't worry, look, there's a wee pot of money back there. We can pull on that from London or whatever, from Edinburgh or something, and it can be used to mitigate maybe a day's investigation, and you don't have to hide the human remains. That would be useful, but that's a whole policy structure. That's a, you know, the obviously be a little bit like with our first segment. We're not going to solve that today, Andy, are we? but the thing is that the human remains thing is worrying because, you know, when you find human remains, they're investigated initially as to whether or not they're recent in terms of a recent murder, perhaps, or, you know, they are problematic. And so if because of this, these interactions, we're actually discouraging people from maybe reporting potential crimes, and this is hypothetical, by the way, then that's a problem. And that must come out of this interaction between people who genuinely want what's best for the historic environment and people who are living in that environment, surely.
I think there is a matter of education about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly in England, historic England, I'm working with other partners in other jurisdictions in the UK, have been developing this concept of heritage crime. They've been prosecuting more cases in a high-profile way, making sure they get into the national press and so on. And the idea is that, say, for example, bulldozing a bit of office dike or a henge, or, in this case, a cairn and Neolithic burial monument or whatever, isn't victimless in that it's, first of all, it's illegal. It's against the law. It's just as illegal as getting into a car and driving off when you've had too much to drink. Mm. It's an antisocial, it's dangerous, and it's an antisocial thing to do, and it's punished by a legal sanction. So no sympathy there, Gov, especially if somebody knew it was illegal. And that in the end is your ultimate recourse. If you can't persuade somebody, if Parliament, Holyrood, whatever, in its collective wisdom, has made something illegal, end of. And yes, you try and moderate it. You try and create a positive relationship with landowners and things like that. But in the end, if you can't achieve that, or they don't want to listen, then you have to be prepared to fall back on the law.
Yeah, and certainly, the historic environment in Scotland, they do, before it gets to that stage of prosecuting someone, there's letters of notice and kind of, you're about to do something or you've started doing something.
Yeah.
Stop now. We're aware of what's happened.
Yeah.
If you stop, we're not going to go any further with it. But in terms of the kind of heritage law and heritage crime, I think historic environment in Scotland have only recently been given the powers to report crime directly to the prosecutor fiscal rather than having to go through police and other things. So, I'm not a legal expert by any stretch of the imagination. If I was, I'd be significantly financially better off.
I can hear my grandparents. Don't do it! Don't! Sorry, go on.
It's probably quite, in terms of the kind of the development of this law and how it's done legally, it's a good thing that there's been a prosecution fairly early on as a precedent of, if you are doing this and Historic Environment Scotland are contacting you, they can then just go to the prosecutor fiscal and you will end up in court and you will end up with consequences. Making examples of people through law, I don't particularly agree with at all, but it's a well publicised thing that's happened, and probably a lot of people who have sigil monuments on their land who haven't really given it much thought will now be more aware.
Yeah.
So that is a kind of a good thing to come out of it. And it's good to see. I mean, reporting something in 2018 and it being done in 2021, obviously with COVID in the way, that's relatively streamlined.
Yeah.
So it obviously has worked, that kind of new legal setup with the struggle that's gone. So that's kind of good to see.
And in fact, I see, certainly the cases I'm aware of in under English legal jurisdiction, and I'm assuming it's similar. I'd obviously, you do have the Procurator Fiscal investigating cases in Scotland, and can instruct the police, can't they, to undertake certain investigations and so on. Slightly different to the way it works in England, but I either way, you have the legal authorities have to apply things like public interest tests to as to whether it's worth actually investing the money that this investigation is going to take in the outcome. So it's not a given, even that, you know, even if you report something up the line in that manner, that it's necessarily going to end up with an investigation, let alone a prosecution in the courts. So you know, there are lots of nuances, you know, lots of steps in between.
Okay. Well, I'll bring this segment to a close just by suggesting a campaign name for awareness, and maybe it should be. You see that hill over there? Maybe you should just hedge your bets. Hey! Hey! Don't knock it down. Don't bulldoze it. Don't clend. Thank you, Neil. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
That's all right.
We do have to apologise for him. He is always like this. It's just enthusiasm. You know how it goes. But in all seriousness, thanks for joining us, because having that perspective, both of us, we were very keen not to be seen to be sort of, again, commenting on the Scottish issue from south of the border here, albeit Mark's only just south of the border.
Actually, on this side of the country, I'm about 112 miles south of the border, actually. So,
yeah. Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
Hey, it's the debatable lands in the old to use the old terms of logic. But in all seriousness, thanks for joining us, because it's been a really, really valuable to have.
This is exactly why people don't like London. Sorry, go on. No, thank you, Neil. Thank you. See you later.
Thanks for thank you.
So thank you once again to Neil Ackerman for his time. You'll be seeing him again in Muppet of the Month. It's a segment that we've recorded with him as well, which is well worth a watch this month, I think. We had some fun. But now we're going to just take a moment just to be quite serious and consider the passing of a colleague and also a supporter of the pipeline. So, Andy, would you like to explain?
Yeah, I'd just like to take a moment, really, to appreciate the work of our late colleague Mike Ingram. Mike was a well-known battlefield historian, a Ricardian, he was an expert on the Wars of the Roses, had written a number of books, and he sadly died a few weeks ago of a heart attack, aged only 59. It's been a huge shock to the relatively small world of battlefield archaeology and battlefield guiding, but also particularly to the community in Northampton, where he was he'd only recently become a freeman of Northampton, a hereditary freeman of Northampton, something he was very proud of. I'm mentioning it here because Mike was a good friend of the pipeline and indirectly of Watching Brief. We worked on a number of stories together, and in fact, it was the work of Mike and his colleagues, which first of all helped protect the registered battlefield of Northampton. That's how I first came to know him, in fact. In 2012, Northampton Borough Council were supporting a development on the site, on the registered battlefield, where, to cut to the chase, all sorts of attempted manipulations of process were going on. Mike had been involved in researching the battlefield and turned actually into a campaigner on the back of it. And that development was eventually headed off. The battlefield is now more properly preserved and understood. It's got proper interpretation boards and so on. And there's even a Northampton Northamptonshire Battlefield Society, which Mike founded, which helps monitor that and other important battlefields in Northamptonshire, including the battlefield of Naseby, the Civil War battlefield of Naseby, and another Wars of the Roses battlefield, Edgecote. So that was one aspect of Mike's work, but he was also instrumental in leading a campaign that got the medieval Eleanor Cross in Northampton properly restored.
Yeah.
And so he is going to be a huge loss. As somebody said to me, they are very big shoes to fill. I think what I would say really is that Mike was the kind of person who is so important in the heritage world. It was somebody who is independent but knows their stuff, somebody who is a brilliant communicator but also isn't afraid to ruffle feathers, even among what might be seen as friendly forces, like, you know, historic England. It's making sure basically that people do their jobs. And he was always there to stand up for the heritage within the community of Northampton and the East Midlands, but Northampton in particular. So a huge loss, not, you know, particularly obviously to his friends and family. So I think it's important at the time of the year when we're all coming together and enjoying our friends, our families, time to be together and so on, to remember the people who've gone. And sadly, Mike is one of those, and only too recently and all too soon.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. Thank you for that, Andy. I suppose we'll end on that note. What I would say is everyone, in that sense, do take time to be grateful for what we have and who we have. And I know in some cases, family relationships, certainly I know from personal experience, can be difficult, and I'm not remotely saying that therefore we should all be grateful for people who aren't necessarily the most helpful in our lives. But there'll be friends, there'll be people that you know, there'll be people who maybe are alone this Christmas, who we can reach out to and just be grateful for. And that is something that's definitely worthwhile doing. Very timely reminder. For my part, as I was saying at the beginning, I'm looking forward to seeing the in-laws. They're coming over, and we're going to have a good few days together for the first time in 2 years. That's definitely something to be grateful for. And I'm looking forward to having hopefully a fairly quiet Christmas. You and I, we are planning on doing a sort of Christmas New Year, so at some point, yet to really tie it down, live stream quiz. I may try and rope some other people in to get involved as well. So keep an eye out for that, guys.
Please.
And also it'll be interactive.
I might pardon me, anything else, I might be too hungover.
Depends on how things go with cabinet, doesn't it, really?
Whatever cabinet decides, I'm equipped, all right?
Yeah, dude, you've got your cabinet over there.
Yes.
But also as well, as I say, check out the Muppet of the Month, a little extra Christmas present for you guys this week. And I'll see you, soon. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. A merry festive season to all of you. Happy holidays, as they say. Take care.
Good y'all.
Good y'all. Bye-bye.
This podcast episode has been produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network in collaboration with ArchaeoSoup Productions. Find out more podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.